A question on African Views. Is freedom in Africa a blessing or a curse? Probably. You wanted to come in there?
Yes. I want to go back to where I should have started and say that freedom for me means the maximization of choices and opportunities for citizens to create a better life for themselves. That's the standard we should set for ourselves. When you look at former liberation movements, you must remember that the liberation struggle came with its mythology. And because of that mythology, you saw ordinary people romanticizing not only the liberation movements, but their leaders. Which means one of the things we need to do as ordinary South Africans, Africans and South Africans, is to demythologize the liberation struggle and liberation movements and the leaders of those liberation movements. And remember that one of the burdens of liberty is eternal, is eternal vigilance, and it therefore means it is the citizen, it is the ordinary African who must be vigilant. Because what I see is a disjuncture that has developed between the leaders and ordinary Africans. And when I listen to a lot of what our African leaders say in the African Union, I don't see myself in them or in what they are saying.
There come times when it is possible to forecast the results of a contest, of a battle, of a lawsuit, or of a struggle long before the final event has taken place. And so far as our struggle for civil rights is concerned, I'm not worried about that now. The struggle for civil rights in America is won. What I am more concerned about is the fact that the Negro shall not be content simply with demanding an equal share in the existing system. It seems to me that his fundamental responsibility and his historical challenge is to use his weight, since he has less to lose in the present system than anybody else or any other group, to make sure that the system which shall survive in the United States of America, I don't care what system you call it, shall be a system which guarantees justice and freedom for everyone. The way I usually put it is, sure, we're being invited now in to take a front seat. But there's no particular honor in being invited to take a front seat at one's own funeral.
The burden of freedom is eternal vigilance. I like that a lot. Hey folks, I just got up off the ground. I did my first perfect push-up in 3 weeks. You'll be glad to know. I want to welcome you July 16th, 2008. Hottest show in the diaspora. I have found the book that's going to bring Africa and the diaspora together. Maddening Behaviors. We'll talk to one of the authors later on today. And I'm looking for two Caucasian snipers to round out my championship contending lineup. My 76ers are going to win it all next year.
We'll be right back.
July 16th, 2008. I'm back. I missed you. I don't even know where to start to tell you how interesting the last 2 weeks were for me. I hope you were able to spend time with loved ones, rejuvenate, reconnect, center yourself. That was some of what I accomplished. So I would give myself a C. I was not able to do all that I intended, but I did take care of some important business in the 2 weeks that we were off. So let me acknowledge me. Glenn from Philly, if you're there, brother, I don't know about this SEC move to curb short selling. Now, I've come a long way on short selling. I was dead against it about 10 years ago. I thought it was wicked, betting against a stock or a currency. Short selling means that you are anticipating the drop in the value of a share of a stock or a currency, and so you bet that the price is going down. I'll explain the process later, but today's Wall Street Journal: SEC moves to curb short selling. Says the Securities and Exchange Commission took unprecedented action against short sellers on Tuesday, acting on a widespread concern that negative bets against bank and brokerage stocks might be exacerbating the financial sector's woes. In a dramatic emergency order, the SEC said it would immediately move to curb improper short selling in the stocks of struggling mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as well as those of 17 financial firms, including Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Morgan Stanley, and Merrill Lynch. The plan, which is expected to go into effect on Monday, will expire in 30 days, but the SEC will also begin considering whether to extend the new requirements to all stocks traded in the United States. The actions represent one of the most extensive attempts by a government agency in recent years to control short selling. Short selling is a legitimate trading strategy in which traders aim to profit from falling stock prices. Shorting can act as a corrective force at times of rampant bullishness in markets, its defenders say, but it has long been controversial because it pits investors, notably hedge funds, against companies that are eager to see their share prices high. Now, you know, I was against short selling because it was used against struggling nations that were trying to get their currencies together. People would bet against the stock. They would go short against it, and they would single-handedly bring down the value of the currency. This is what Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir accused George Soros of doing in 1997. I also thought that short selling was a way to pick on smaller companies who don't have the ability or who are very vulnerable to the influence of a group of powerful investors. So if a group of powerful investors, hedge funds, for example, were to bet against the stock of Radio One, they could single-handedly destroy that stock. So I was a little wary. However, when I began to see how derelict the financial media has been and financial analysts have been in scrutinizing shenanigans in publicly traded companies, I began to think that short sellers were performing us a public service by looking deeper behind the numbers and exposing deceptive financial and accounting practices of major companies. Then I came across two books that I want to highly recommend that totally persuaded me to give short selling a chance. So I'm 50-50 on short selling. The two books you want to get, and maybe Glenn from Philly will add on, but the two books on short selling, one, the best book is called Sold Short: Uncovering Deception in the Markets by Manuel P. Asensio, and The Art of Short Selling by Catherine F. Staley, S-T-A-L-E-Y. We'll talk about it later. Just want to let you know I have not slipped on my grind, even though I want to give Ed Stefanski an honorary original man notification notice. That's the GM of the Philadelphia 76ers. the man that went out and signed Elton Brand. Now, I was hoping that we would get Josh Smith of the Atlanta Hawks. But brother Ed Stefanski, I'm feeling you right now. And I would like to say that although we are not on the level of the Boston Celtics, if the Philadelphia 76ers can acquire not one, but two Caucasian snipers, and a Caucasian sniper is a talented outside shooter, a three-point shooter that's white. You got to have a white three-point shooter. So I want two. And my big brother called me yesterday and put me up on, he did the knowledge on one of them, which is Steve Novak from the Houston Rockets. Shane from Houston. We're looking at Steve Novak, who's on your squad, the Houston Rockets, and the great forgotten college white hope, J.J. Redick. So if we can get J.J. Redick and Steve Novak, you'll be seeing us in the finals next year playing the Lakers. Yep. So we got a lot of feedback on the show that we did on teenage daughters. A lot of you sent me your emails. Sitting Spook in East Orange and Prince from Chicago and several others said that they wished that they had caught that show live. So we may revisit the relationship between fathers and daughters. Those of you that caught the CNN special, Daughters of Legacy, that goes right into our topic. The daughters of Muhammad Ali, Elhaj Malik Shabazz, Malcolm X, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Sidney Poitier, and who did I miss? Johnny Cochran? They were all featured. Okay. Natasha has weighed in. Hello, I missed you. I know you really took time off to scout the AKA convention. Now, hold on now. I walked up on an AKA yesterday, and indeed, the AKAs were deep out here in D.C. Missed you too, Natasha. She says, how are you doing? And she greets the whole family. Natasha from Miami has something special for you later. Eleazar from Brooklyn. He says, we all miss you and thankful that you're able to come back on the airwaves. I caught your interview with Davey D. I appreciate your time and insight, but I oppose you on your prediction. Let me clarify. The media has made John McCain president. Europe favors him. Obama favors Obama over McCain. And one final consideration. I don't know what Eleazar is trying to say here, but he's saying, Cedric, in the result of the financial crisis here in the States, how important is dual citizenship? And should we look into Grenada as a safe haven since it's one of the top Caribbean countries? Peace to Rosa Clemente and presidential nominee Cynthia McKinney. Shalom. Okay, now hold on. Eleazar hit me with a lot. Eleazar is referring to my interview granted to Davey D. Davey D and I were hanging out at the ACLU Confidential Informant Conference right after that started my break off. Friday the 26th, I think. So Davey and I were hanging out with the great Ann Dayano and the ACLU, a great conference, talking about the dangers of the current policies and manners in which confidential informants, snitches, are being treated. They're given a lot of leeway to put you behind in jail. So we had a conference on that. But while we were there, Davey and I hooked up, and I gave him an interview. And I think it looked like I punched Davey in the stomach when I told him that John McCain is going to be the next president of the United States. Davey D, I mean, he looked like I had given him cyanide. So Eleazar heard that interview. We may play some of that. I'm not backing off my prediction. John McCain will be POTUS. POTUS 08. I did catch Cynthia McKinney and Rosa Clemente, my two friends, securing the Green Party nomination on C-SPAN. I think next week or the week after, let's do a show, a topic, a second cup, on what Cynthia McKinney's candidacy means for the black electorate and how we should relate. Now, Eleazar, to your third question, your third point, how important is dual citizenship, and should we look into Grenada as a safe haven since it's one of our top Caribbean countries. Well, I was reading Fall of America this morning, and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said it is not important to just leave America. He said you must leave the American ideology behind. I'll get that page for you. Fall of America. I read that this morning, Eleazar. That's my answer. I respect Randall Robinson for breaking out of the United States. I got love for him, but I don't think just a mass exodus, if you're going to take the Negro mindset and the American ideology with you, is sufficient. We will get kicked out of these Caribbean countries where we're going. Somebody look into the knowledge of the relationship between Haile Selassie and the followers of Marcus Garvey. There was some tension because the American so-called Negro went over there and was not acting right. He may be listening. I want to acknowledge the great hater, star of Star and Buck Wild. Caught his one of the ways I relaxed on July 4th, the 78th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence of Master Farad Muhammad, July 4th, 1930. I celebrated that day in part by listening to Star's excellent interview with the former lead singers of Chic, or the members of Chic. If you caught that, let me know. It's excellent. The kind of interview that only Star can do. With his sense of humor, encyclopedic knowledge of music. Pulse 87 is where Star does his show in New York. And if you want to catch it online, pulse87.com. It's P-U-L-S-E, number 8, number 7.com. Okay? Excellent interview. I spent one day at the beach. It was so hot, I underestimated the power of the sun. I had to spend $15 on a umbrella and a chair. But I did get one day in the beach. If you got a day in at the beach, let me know. Shane from Houston says, good day, Cedric. The 76ers do look good, but I only see the second round of the playoffs. Go Rockets. Did you catch jazz singer Renee Marie sing the national black anthem in Denver? I agree. Steve Novak is a sharpshooter, but he can't rebound. Philly should get him. The Clippers acquired Marcus Camby. Does he back up? Who's that? Kamen? Or does he go to the four? Well, Camby can play. I'd rather see Camby at the four if you have a good center. I don't know what the Clippers look like now that Elton Brand left. That was a good look for the Clippers. So they got Brandon Davis and Marcus Camby now. Good look. Send your comments through if you're a first-time viewer, the most important person in the room. I got in my hands the hottest book in the diaspora, Maddening Behaviors, Some I Hear, A Lot I See, by Tara Nichols and Nicole Shivers. As you all know, I'm a current event, political affairs, economic, analytical reader. I prefer nonfiction. But there's certain things that you can only learn in life, I think, through storytelling, arts and culture, dramatization, all based upon truth, reality, personal experience. So in this book, Maddening Behaviors, Some I Hear, A Lot I See, we have an instrument. And God bless them. God bless Nicole and Tara, because this book is only 109 pages. I don't know how they did it. You can go to myspace.com/maddeningbehaviors. MaddeningBehaviors. We'll talk about this book, how I think it brings together Africa and the diaspora in a unique way, primarily by making us sensitive to the ignorance, cultural worldviews, and historical legacy on both sides of the Atlantic. And towards that end, all of you beloved African listeners that I have, please stop trying to hug up on Senator Barack Obama like how we hugged up on President Nelson Mandela. Stop it. We still got problems in the United States of America. Stop doing that. I had to check you. Some of my family in Africa really has a silly view of the black man and woman of America. That's why I like this book, Maddening Behaviors, because it does deal with that. Many people in Africa getting their image of black people in America from BET and rap music. So now the highlight of my time off was that I got acquainted with international news at such an intimate level. I sat and watched French news, Russian news, and South African news nonstop. I turned off CNN, Fox. I even turned off CNBC and Bloomberg. Cut my viewing time around the 10% level. I was watching 90% Russian, French, and South African news. I recommend you all do that if you have access to it on DirecTV or cable. But when I was watching the program called Russia Today, I knew I was on the right path when I heard this news report. This was the second day that I was watching Russian news. Listen to what I caught.
Moving on, organizers boast the Splash Festival to be the hugest European hip-hop and rap event. Finally, it's appeared in Russia, bringing the local hip-hop musicians and world headliners on one scene. But, as Mikhail Koshikov reports, it's the American duo M.O.P., which were the heroes of the evening.
This is M.O.P. Even if you're not into hip-hop music, there's a good chance you've heard these tunes. These songs are just the tip of a catalog that has acquired a huge underground following. Coming from Brooklyn's Bronzeville, a part of the city known for its gang warfare, the rappers knew each other from childhood. So it was not difficult for the musicians to pick up a new follower to join their gang, this time a Muscovite. M.O.P. is short for Mesh Out Posse, a name of a gang headed by the brother of one of the musicians. The violence, death and blood they saw on the streets and in their private lives had a strong influence on their music and their first album. The second CD was more successful and featured performers like Naughty by Nature and Jay-Z. The self-produced Cold as Ice, one of the band's most popular singles, required almost half of its lyrics to be censored for the radio version. With Alcohol, Precious Metals and Blin Blin, M.O.P. are still on top of hip-hop, but sometimes they look as though the last 20 years have left them exhausted. Mikhail Kochikov, RT, Moscow.
Never a surrogate.
Hey, listen, M.O.P. on Russian TV. We got to educate our Russian brothers on what a gang really is. But when you're talking about M.O.P., I got to play this real quick. Cedric Muhammad, Black Coffee Program, July 16th, 2008. We'll be back. Come on.
Legends, you heard me? Make a note of it. Yeah, yo, I got 7 Mac 11s, about 8, 38s, 9-9s, Mac 10s, man, this never end. Even if the apple won't spin, I reach in my back pocket and blast you with his twin. It's yelling out the window, Joe's at it again. But this bastard got lawyers, keep him out of the pen. I mean, feds wanna knock me just cause I'm cocky and arrogant. Wave high when they watch me, can't stop me. Every time more fish, you better find my residuals or this not gonna lift you. He was a fine individual with the paper scripture, had him on the front page in his graduation pictures. And they probably never hit you if you brought your clock.
Ending whackness in the name of blackness. You are listening to the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Show only at blackcoffeechannel.com.
They got M. O. P. We got guns, big ones, extra large, humongous. They won't fit up under your car seat, pop in a heartbeat. Keep the cannon in my reach, lay you flat on your back like you was tanning on the beach. We keep them things full of hollows, and I'm from Christopher. Bang with the Wallace, Fitzroy. You ain't loco, you buttocks, boy, your heart pumps and loco. Rounds feel deep in my jeans, I show you bad boy for real. Keep thinking sh**, it's peaches and cream.
We're running you down.
Mo' peace, hunt you down, turn you down. Gun sing like blah. Raise up, cop, pop my biscuit. For my OG head, twist it. We got guns.
We got guns.
Crazy, ill, mad, rowdy.
I got shit locked, bringing the noise, bringing the funk, pop the Glock. But only if you feel this sh**.
Blackness in the name of blackness. You are listening to the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Show only at blackcoffeechannel.com.
My priorities ain't based on fun. I'm trying to cop some more property in the case of them guns. Sick societies got guru protecting his fam. prudential. I got my own protection plan. Respect me, man. I'm on a mission, so to speak. You're too dumb to play a position, so you leave. I trade HME, vacate the street. Gangstar, first fan of TS, we way deep. And even if you had a thought to move on us, our firepower will devour, choke you on dust. Slow death, no breath, hollow salve, you gasping. You rich, just for you, we got a lavish casket. Call us savage bastards, using all means necessary. It's only customary, it's you we got to bury. We're dead, your thug network. Headshots make your neck jerk. My marksman on the roof, he's an expert.
Who got a problem? It's already been established. I come through your town with a pound like a sack. Still throwing down on the grounds that I'm average. Can I hear for a gangster? Yeah! It's always some but it's always a clip to reroute your doubts and see what you're about. Your homeboys are snitching, your boss man's a we taking over these bricks. Is that you? Doing underhanded I'll shoot you in your abdomen, you fraud. You moving like a blow with the then you deserve a home in the back of your mother head. The doctor can't fix on the concrete. We palm heat like soldiers. Spit one in your whip and flip your over. Keep in mind, whatever the non-spit, it's only as good as it behind it. We got guns,
guns, guns.
When we talk freedom in Africa, madam, do you really think it is understood from a point of liberation? When we look at liberation movements on the continent, do they really understand the freedom they've gained after the liberation struggle?
I think I'm going to have to agree with what Professor Siepe and my colleague here were saying earlier about the sustainability after the struggle takes place in terms of liberation movements. I'm going to take Asia again as an example, because they also colonized some of those countries, but they managed to move, like taking Vietnam, you know, despite that horrible bombing that they underwent and the fact that they're still communists, they were able to still sustain and move forward and develop their economy and move forward in that. Where we fail in Africa, what I think is that back to the issue of sustainability, we get the freedom, but then instead of moving into the economic arena, which is the key essential thing if you're going to talk about democracy. You cannot have democracy without economic growth. Those two go hand in hand. And the issue of political freedom is it's a dicey word, as I think my colleague was saying, because you look at the United States. I mean, everyone knows that George Bush allegedly stole the elections. And so, but we have George Bush criticizing Mugabe in Zimbabwe about the elections, not to say that either is right or wrong, but I'm just saying the thing of political freedom also, and you go beyond the liberation period, it's a long process, and even when a country has gotten it right, like the United States, there are still issues. Like in the United States, the rate of blacks in prison is one of the highest in the world. Mm. What does it say about freedom? Mm. So the political freedom to me, I don't know if it's as, I think what's really more critical for Africa right now is to emulate what some of these Asian countries have done, like China. I mean, China has raised about 400 million people out of poverty. That's more than the people on this continent. That to me is more critical than anything.
So we're going to put this question before the floor today regarding African freedom and liberation. Now, there's an article at thefinalcall.com. You can see it at blackelectorate.com. And we link to it today in the national, international section. Now, the situation in Zimbabwe, the way I got into it, because I want to be very clear about why I have the perspective that I do. My brother from another mother, Double M, Mark Miller, he has sent me right around 2001, I think, one of the messages that the opposition party in Zimbabwe, the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, sends out. So it was an economic policy description that laid out what they hoped to do if they came into power. So I read it. I thought it was straight trash. I'm going to be honest with you. I thought it was garbage that could have been written by the IMF. But a gentleman by the name of Eddie Cross was the author's name. And so I actually wrote him and I challenged him to a debate publicly. And that's still up at blackelectorate.com. So this man, Eddie Cross, if Tsvangirai had become president in 2002, This man, Eddie Cross, was in line to be the Secretary of the Treasury. So I was having a dialogue with the man who would potentially become the Secretary of the Treasury or Finance Minister in the event that Mugabe lost to Morgan Tsvangirai. Now, what I see people feeling that they have to do is they have to pick sides. They have to defend Brother President Mugabe, or they have to take the side of the opposition party. If I had to choose, which I don't think I do, but if I had to, I would defend Mugabe. But I would not do so ignorant of the reality that the African Liberation Movement or the African Independence Movement has failed at governance. It has failed at translating the military work of taking the yoke of the oppressor off your back into programs, policies, and governance that's effective at addressing problems of poverty, wealth distribution, economic growth. Now, anyone who so what do you do now? Either the revolution is not done, and you all who have been embracing this mindset that Africa was free or liberated or made independent need to go back and finish the job, if you know what I'm saying. You can't have it both ways. You can't say that Europe and America are still oppressing you and then tell me that you were liberated and gained independence at the barrel of a gun. So, I got this gentleman, Eddie Cross, the man who would become the finance minister of Zimbabwe in 2002, had his party won. He admitted to me that the economic plan of the MDC had been approved of in advance by the IMF and the World Bank. This is a fact. Okay? Now, the Zimbabwe government didn't give me that information. Little activists that hate Mugabe didn't give me this information. I got it on my own, directly from this man, Eddie Cross. He told me that they showed their economic platform to the IMF and the World Bank and got their approval. Now, let me give you a little background on Zimbabwe. Just a little something to add a little more context. Okay. This is from something from a few years ago, but it's got some good information. According to this source, it says here, around the middle of the 19th century, this territory of Zimbabwe, known as the House of Stone, Great Zimbabwe, developed by the ancestors of the Shona people. This territory was invaded by what they call Ndebele or Matabele immigrants from the south. In 1890, Cecil John Rhodes, British South Africa Company, the BSA, started a white settlement at Salisbury, which is known today as Harare, the capital of Zimbabwe. The territory was named Rhodesia after Rhodes, Cecil John Rhodes. Territory was named Rhodesia after Rhodes, and in 1923, white settlers were given the choice of joining South Africa or becoming a self-governing colony within the British Empire. Are you listening? They opted for the latter. By law, the best cropland was reserved for a rapidly growing white settlement, restricting blacks to the grazing areas. Joshua Mabuko and Komo's Zimbabwe African People's Union, ZAPU, ZAPU, and Robert Gabriel Mugabe's Zimbabwe Africa National Union, ZANU, led the black protest against this inequity. Okay, so you had Nkomo and Mugabe, ZAPU and ZANU, against the white monopoly of the best land, okay, that the whites had settled and stolen and invaded. Mugabe and Nkomo resorted to arms in 1965 when Prime Minister Ian Smith and his ruling Rhodesian Front issued a unilateral declaration of independence, the UDI. the UN-imposed sanctions, and a protracted guerrilla war on two fronts involving ZAPU and ZANU forced Ian Smith to the negotiating table. And in April 1980, Zimbabwe gained independence under Prime Minister, later President, Robert Mugabe. A quota of 20 seats was temporarily reserved for whites, and Mugabe soon nullified Nkomo's role and his newly formed ZANU Patriotic Front, won 116 of the 120 parliamentary seats in 1990, which gave Mugabe a virtual one-man, one-party rule. Land resettlement has been at the center of an ongoing political battle since. One-third of the country's arable land is owned by 4,000 white farmers. And Mugabe's support for forceful occupation of white farmland by displaced war veterans has placed him at the center of a storm that led to the near victory of the opposition movement for democratic change, MDC, in the June 2000 elections. Okay? Just a little background so you understand. So the question now before us, in many ways, is a false one. We have to pick between Mugabe and Tsvangirai. But if you just take note of what I read to you, you know that the issue is bigger. Now, in my new program of watching international news, I wanted to bring to you all some additional perspectives. I caught this on Russian TV. Interesting. Some subtle things said here. Listen up. This is Russian TV, the Russian news, talking about the situation in Zimbabwe.
Let's go back to the land issue. As far as I can remember, some time ago there was a referendum and Mugabe did not get enough votes. Nonetheless, he did confiscate land. Why did he do this?
After any revolution, revolutionaries tend to ask this question. What did we fight for in the first place? He had to justify his actions in the eyes of his fellow fighters. He had to show them why they were fighting for Zimbabwe's independence. He had to offer them something other than patriotic speeches about black brotherhood and victory over capitalism. He needed to give them something tangible. As I told you before, his governors, his key people got their land from white farmers. They were not just lost. Zimbabwean leaders received that land. He needed to lure them somehow, and so he did. Mm-hmm. As far as I could tell, he didn't care much for his people, like many country leaders, but he did care for the leaders of the country, because it is the ruling group that determines whether Mugabe will stay in power or not. They will also decide if Zimbabwe will stay the way it is, or if it will become a state modeled on Great Britain, the United States, or South Africa. That is why he's taken good care of his elite people, even though on the surface everything looks very austere. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us. And just a reminder that our guest today was Rustam Arifchanov, one of the few journalists who has ever managed to interview the president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe.
Now, on this program and others, and in articles I notice, and in what I just read to you, everyone acknowledges the disproportionate amount of control of resources held by a very small minority of whites. Nobody ever shows me how that was adequately resolved. Nobody shows me how Mugabe adequately resolved it. Nobody shows me how the West or the British or the opposition party has adequately resolved that. Now let me read this article from The Final Call. Cover story last week in the greatest newspaper on earth. We have a correspondent on the ground in Zimbabwe. I'll get to that in a minute. What's Next for Zimbabwe by Saeed Shabazz. Let me read this to you. Robert Mugabe, 84, has been elected president of Zimbabwe for another 6 years. The United Nations, pushed by the United States, Britain, France, Australia, and Canada, says the election did not reflect the will of the Zimbabwean people. President Bush has condemned the voting as a sham as the U.S. threatens an arms embargo and other measures to force Mr. Mugabe to step down. Listen up. The pressure of the West hasn't been effective thus far on African leaders and governments. Quote, of course, we discussed the issue of Zimbabwe, where we understand your concerns. But I want to assure you that the concerns you have expressed are indeed the concerns of many of us on the African continent, said President Kikwete of Tanzania, Jakaya Kikwete, the president of the African Union as well. He was responding to President Bush on July 8th at the meeting of the Group of Eight World Economic Leaders in Toyoko, Japan. Now, on that meeting, the Group of Eight has no African nations among it. And to show you how elite some of the Western powers are, they selected seven African leaders to come privately meet with them so that they could twist their arm on Zimbabwe. President Kikwete says, "We are saying no party can govern alone in Zimbabwe, and therefore the parties have to work together to come up to come out, work together in a government, and then look at the future of their country together." Now, before we we've zoomed in on Zimbabwe. Let me pull it back out. Let's take a larger view of the whole concept of African independence, African freedom, African liberation. This is from the program African Visions on the South African Broadcasting Network. Check this out.
When we talk freedom in Africa, madam, do you really think it is understood from a point of liberation? When we look at liberation movements on the continent, do they really understand the freedom they've gained after the liberation struggle?
I think I'm going to have to agree with what Professor Siepe and my colleague here were saying earlier about the sustainability after the struggle takes place in terms of liberation movements. I want to take Asia again as an example, because they also colonized some of those countries, but they managed to move, like taking Vietnam, you know, despite that horrible bombing that they underwent and the fact that they're still communists, they were able to still sustain and move forward and develop their economy and move forward in that. Where we fail in Africa, what I think is that, back to the issue of sustainability, we get the freedom, but then instead of moving into the economic arena, which is the key essential thing if you're going to talk about democracy. You cannot have democracy without economic growth. Those two go hand in hand.
Now, thank you, sister. Has economic growth been addressed? Now, here, I saw the SADC mediator. I'll talk about SADC in a minute. Saying that we are imposing democracy, or we are for spreading democracy among the Southern African nations. And then they brought up the issue of Swaziland. Swaziland is ruled by a king. There's no democracy. How can that man, the ruler of Swaziland, tell Robert Mugabe that you have to have a democracy? I believe Angola has only had like one election in the last 30 years. So why are African nations being forced to promote democracy before the more pressing issue of economic wealth redistribution or growth? Do you see something at work? I saw Russian President Medvedev say that democracy does not necessarily mean freedom. And he said, look at what the United States has not been able to do in Iraq and Afghanistan. So this SADC mediator, he was saying, he was practically admitting, we don't know why as African nations we promote democracy. It was an admission of something. Well, we know that one of the reasons is because the United States mandates that. One of the ways you can control a government is by mandating democracy so that you can support an opposition party or both sides if you want. Now, we'll talk about the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman. But through the World Bank, IMF, and through quote unquote free and fair elections, through the WTO, through trade agreements, you can effectively get anything you want from an African nation, from a Caribbean nation, from a poor nation because of the debt, because of their need for debt, financial investment, and foreign aid. So through the IMF, World Bank, WTO, and forcing a country to have free and fair elections, you can control them through those multilateral institutions, the United Nations votes as well, and of course, an opposition party. Now, remember what I said. The man who would have become the finance minister of Zimbabwe told me that the IMF and World Bank approved of their economic plan before that election in 2002, I believe. There's some little known facts that we need to get into. So my question for the Pan-Africanist revolutionary supporters of Robert Mugabe is, at what point is he or any African leader accountable for governing, though? I mean, can you always point to the external hidden hand while you say you are president because you got the people independence? If the external hand is still manipulating you, then you're not independent. I mean, am I off base here? So you need to get back to the revolution. This is what I'm saying. Maybe you need to not be president. Maybe you need to be general again. So there's game playing, I think, on both sides. You all agree, you can disagree with me. I just think many of us are trying to have it both ways. Some of us want to criticize the quote-unquote African dictator and then ignore the fact that America had over hundreds of years to get democracy right and still hasn't gotten it right, as this sister makes clear. Listen to what this sister on the program African Vision says about America's democracy. Please continue.
And the issue of political freedom is very, very, it's a dicey word, as I think my colleague was saying, because you look at the United States, I mean, everyone knows that George Bush allegedly stole the elections. And so, but we have George Bush criticizing Mugabe in Zimbabwe about the elections, not to say that either is right or wrong, but I'm just saying the thing of political freedom also, and you go beyond the liberation period. It's a long process, and even when a country has gotten it right, like the United States, there are still issues. Like, I mean, the United States, the rate of blacks in prison is one of the highest in the world. Mm. What does it say about freedom? Mm. So the political freedom to me, I don't know if it's as, I think what's really more critical for Africa right now is to emulate what some of these Asian countries have done, like China. I mean, China has raised about 400 million people out of poverty. That's more than the people on this continent. That to me is more critical than anything.
So the question for the African leader is, how long does it take for you to effectively govern your people or to effectively cultivate younger leadership, more experienced, more technically sound, but respectful to the legacy of the struggle, types of individuals so that you can have an effective government? There's a lot of backdoor dealing, even with some of these African dictators. They're doing business with the West behind the door or with Asia. Or Europe. So how does that fit into the independence, quote unquote, or liberation movement? Help me out. Send your comments through the box. We can go on this for a while. Let me give you another something to chew on. This deals with the concept of freedom in Africa again.
Dr. Sepe, question to you. Is freedom really understood? Listening to what Victor is saying and also what Madame April is saying, is the concept of freedom really understood in the African context, especially when one looks at it when one comes out of a liberation struggle?
Yeah, I don't think people are confused about the state of being free, because they know what oppression means, and they know what being poor means. So they know what it means not to have control of your life. So that state of being free, it comes from the experience of the lack of it. They know that. What is important to raise, though, is to pursue the point that Aubrey was putting across. And this weekend, the president of Liberia put it very nicely. She says, Africa is not poor, but Africa has been poorly been managed. And what she was actually doing was looking at the resources. Where one of the, this is one continent that has the resources that the world wants. But what has happened is that our economy, to use Aubrey's word, has been subverted. That it's an extroverted economy, an economy that does not serve the interests of Africans. We still are trapped in the colonial framework where there is extraction and which benefits the metropoles or the colonial masters. What we needed to do is to, when you talk about liberation, you also liberate yourself from that stranglehold that we've had economically, where the material resources of Africa begin to serve Africans. And one of the interesting things is that if you look at all a number of our countries, we trade more with our colonial masters than we trade amongst ourselves. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we continue to poorly mismanage manage our own resources to the benefit of Africans. So until such time that we begin to start talking about these resources and how they can benefit all of us. I mean, we always talk about the resources being the stuff that you inherit. And that part we have not done well. And there has been progress. I mean, for instance, the dictatorial tendencies that had existed in Africa, we've seen our African leaders and the sophistication of the masses saying we are no longer going to allow people to overstay their welcome despite the contribution struggle. That in itself is progress. It is progress that comes from the experiment. And unfortunately, when we become free, we always think that our countries are exceptional. That has been the difficulty that we faced in Zimbabwe, in Zambia, and even in South Africa. But the lessons of history are becoming so clear that the people in Africa begin to make far greater demands. And those demands are not only in the political sphere, they are also in the economic sphere, and they are also in education. And I do think that if one were to look at progress, we are actually making progress. It may be slower than we would have expected, but the progress is being made.
Okay, now again, for the record, to give some folks the red meat that they need, if I had to choose, I would choose the side of Mugabe over the MDC, primarily for the reasons I told you. But let me point out some facts like this. Somebody quietly put me up on the fact that the UK South Africa Anglo-American Mining Company put $10 million into a Zimbabwe mining project last year at the same time that the UK government and the Americans were ramping up economic sanctions in the name of democracy and human rights. How can you have it both ways? Now, there's a hell of an intersection between the concerned about Africa activists in America, the European governments, NGOs inside of the country. So you have some of you all trying to get the United States and the UK government to call for genocide, etc., in Sudan. But America and England are doing business behind the door. The UK government getting busy in Zimbabwe at the same time they're trying to get rid of Mugabe. So be careful. Oh, speaking of Sudan, let me pump this report to you. Those of you know that the president of Sudan is being, I guess, indicted by the International Court on charges of genocide. I tell you what, if you want to get a war started real quick, you all go up in Khartoum and try to arrest him. See how that flies over. Sometimes I think folks really do want war. That's why you talk about stupid stuff like bombing Iran. Check this out. Three different reports from the African news that I am watching nonstop these days. This is from Monday. I don't think you heard about this on the ground in America.
China has expressed grave concern and misgivings over the International Criminal Court, or the ICC, seeking an arrest warrant for Sudan's president, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, on charges of genocide in the region of Darfur. The Far East Asian country is also defending its weapons sales to Sudan, claiming it does not export weapons to countries and regions which are subject to UN arms embargoes.
China expresses grave concern and misgivings over the International Criminal Court's accusation on Sudan's state leader.
The ICC's actions must be beneficial to the stability of the Darfur region and the appropriate settlement of the issue, not the contrary.
The Chinese government has always been responsible in exporting military articles, but have strict regulations and domestic laws.
We do not export weapons to countries and regions which are subject to UN arms embargo.
China is a major investor in Sudanese oil. The international calls to stop bloodshed in Darfur, China backed the UN resolution, authorizing the hybrid UN-African Union peacekeeping force, pressured Bashir to accept the force. China confirmed that 172 Chinese peacekeepers will head to Darfur on Wednesday, bringing all its 315 promised peacekeepers into place.
The Sudanese leader says the ICC has no jurisdiction in Sudan. President al-Bashir says its charges against him are all lies. The ICC has accused him of genocide and war crimes in Darfur. Mr. Bashir says that from the outset, Sudan has always maintained that it was not a member of the Hague-based court.
The embattled Sudanese president was speaking during the signing of Sudan's new election law. The election law is expected to pave the way for Sudan's first free elections in 23 years, due in 2009. But analysts have warned the ICC warrant could remove the incentive for Bashir to hold a democratic vote and relinquish power.
Whoever has visited Darfur, met officials and discovered their ethnicities and tribes, whether the government or the judiciary or any other body, will know that all of these things are lies.
Meanwhile, the African Union wants the ICC to suspend any moves to arrest President Bashir to help efforts to end internal strife in Sudan. Speaking on behalf of President Jakaya Kikwete, who heads the AU, Tanzanian Foreign Affairs Minister Bernard Membe says by arresting Mr. Bashir, the ICC will create a leadership vacuum in Sudan. Mr. Membe added that there will be an increase in anarchy and risk of military coups. Foreign ministers of the Arab League will meet on Saturday to discuss the issue.
Another quick trip back to Sudan. Around 100 women have staged a protest in the capital, Khartoum. They were demonstrating against the war crimes charges leveled against their president, that's Omar al-Bashir, by the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
Protesting outside the United Nations Mission in Sudan building, women carried placards and chanted anti-ICC and US slogans. The International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor asked judges on Monday to grant an arrest warrant for President Omar Hassan al-Bashir for genocide, war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur. Women representing different organizations in Sudan handed a petition into the UNMISS headquarters in Khartoum. Protesters had this to say. All Sudanese people stand together against the unfair indictment, and we disagree with the order taken by the ICC. We will overturn the table in the face of the ICC, and we will show them that the people are stronger than them and that the people are stronger than the government. On Tuesday, the United Nations told its staff in Khartoum to stay at home as thousands of Sudanese prepared to rally in support of their president.
Ending whackness in the name of blackness. You are listening to the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Show only at blackcoffeechannel.com.